When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
If you work in quality control at a candy factory, you know strict safety regulations come with the job. It's why you partner with Grainger. Grainger helps you find the high quality and compliant products your business needs to inspect, detect, and help correct issues. And the sweetest part is, everyone gets a product that's as safe to eat as it is delicious. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, it's John Pollock, and we're providing a free sample from Rewind to SmackDown last Friday night, where Neil Flanagan and I sat down to share our thoughts on the recent edition of Hollywood Demons entitled The Real Iron Claw, focusing on the Von Erich family and sort of a postscript to the Iron Claw film that came out at the end of 2023. This has received tremendous reviews, so here is Neil and I talking about the history of the Von Erichs, what is covered in the episode, specific comments from various family members that participated, and where this special stacks among all the media that has been out there over the years covering the family. For more bonus content like this, consider signing up at postwrestlingcafe.com. So let's move on over. This will be our last topic that we discuss. And so earlier this week, we got this Hollywood Demons episode, The Real Iron Claw, focusing on the Von Erich family. And I had heard about this, that they were filming this, and I didn't know to the extent that they were going to have participation from the Von Erich family. I knew that Chris Jericho and MJF were part of this. And that was kind of interesting, too, in the fact that you had MJF in this. And, I mean, the way it's kind of been promoted and received that I've seen from various, like, Hollywood Reporter and such is, you know, with the title, like, The Real Iron Claw is, like, this is this pushback against the film. And while there is that, and they go through discrepancies or omissions from the movie, I did not watch this as some kind of, like angst towards the film. I think it was, like, its own thing. And just sitting down and watching this, as someone that has followed this very closely, I found a lot of stuff like really revelatory and new or different perspectives on things. And I'm kind of curious as well for yourself, Neil, like going into this, kind of just your overall familiarity with the Von Erich story and kind of what your interest was before I saddled you and begged you to spend two more hours watching wrestling this week.
It was a good watch, though. It was well worth my time. I'm not as steeped in the history of this as you are, John, and I know you will have an awful lot of the facts and dates and figures, you know, at the tip of your tongue that I will not have. But I'm aware, you know, I'm aware that there were five Von Erich children and what happened to four of them. You know, I watched the film. I read about some of the discrepancies in it, and I remember not to saddle you with this on air, but I think it might be timely to re-release your audio documentary that you did at the time, because that was a really good kind of informative, here's what really happened with news reports and clips in there. So I knew a good deal about it.
Did you see the movie when it came out?
Yes, I did.
Okay, gotcha. So some of the subjects in this included Kevin Von Erich, who is he's spectacular in this. Yeah. And then other Von Erichs include Carrie's daughters, both Lacey Von Erich, who you would have been familiar with during her time in TNA, and Holly, who is the older daughter of Carrie. So they would have been 9 and 6, respectively. Holly was 9 and Lacey was 6 when Carrie died in 93. You also had Pam Adkisson, who is Kevin's wife. They had Dave Manning, who was the referee, worked in the office and was very close. Also, and this was someone I was not familiar with, Bill Colville, who was the Von Erich bodyguard. Mm-hmm. And I get like he escorted them to the rings and was kind of just there as sort of like, you know, he just worked with all the kids and the family. But I've never heard this guy do any interviews before this as well. MJF and Jericho were there. Like they do give the perspective of sort of like they understand the story, like MJF and Jericho, they both like know their history and stuff like that. Yeah. And they're a tie to the modern. But I wouldn't say added too much in terms of this and hearing from people that had like direct ties to the family, which I found to be the most interesting. Other people were Brian Adias, who was a wrestler in World Class and also went to school with both. He was the same age as Kerry. So they were like classmates together and then would work together. And the host of this is Dr. Drew Pinsky. And so I have not seen any other of these episodes of Hollywood Demons. I was not even familiar with this until this episode. How did you feel Dr. Drew contributed to this? Because they kind of leaned on him for kind of assessing some of the more like technical aspects of some of these deaths, primarily David's one that they talk about from 1984.
It was an interesting format. I thought the documentary was put together very well. There is no narration voice outside of the people that you mentioned. I think there's also a culture writer. Is it Scatchy? I don't know, butcher her name.
Scatchy Cool, which I might be butchering. She was just identified as a culture writer, but I wasn't familiar with her either.
The story is told through all of these voices rather than being an overarching narrator. And I think the way they did it worked rather well. And you mentioned what MJF and Chris Jericho brought to it, but I think they were sort of there to be part of the narrative structure and really to kind of be almost sort of semi-historians of, you know, we are wrestlers, so we can say that this is how it was or that sort of thing. Pinsky, I'm not familiar with him. I did sort of recognize the guy. I think I've seen him pop up on other American shows.
Yeah, he's pretty well known, at least in, you know, anyone of like, especially in the US.
He seemed authoritative in what he was saying. There was some level of speculative stuff about, you know, the cause of deaths. And
I found that too, and we'll get into a bit of that.
Yeah.
I will say, and I had this like recommended to me, so I was looking forward to sitting down and reading. The very first thing is this stat on the screen. 90 million fans follow professional wrestling in the US. I mean, that's the first thing I see. So my guard goes up immediately when I see this ridiculous stat at the beginning. But I mean, that was not central to any of this. So it starts off and they kind of just recap a bit of, you know, the Iron Claw, it's this big movie from A24, but they give the premise that was not the full story. And it's Kevin stating, you know, I endorsed the movie, but the family is stating, like, we learned about this reading about it on social media. Like, we were never consulted in advance. And Kevin notes the fact, I endorsed the movie, but I do want to correct the record. And I don't know, like, if that was sort of like the hook for this of, hey, it's the real story of the Von Erichs. Like, you never got them like trying to like bury this film. No. Or it was more so just, and it's one that, yeah, there were certainly creative licenses. And if you listen back at the time to our review of it, like we kind of go through what happened, what did not. It seems like at the top of it was the omission of Chris Von Erich, who was one of the sons that was not included in the film as well. Timelines that did not mesh with reality. And this is really something that you are going to get in these films. Like, that is going to happen. But it did not feel to me like this was like the Von Erichs denouncing this movie or anything like that. It was more so here's the additional information and telling a more complete story than the movie could provide.
Sure. I didn't see any promotion for the documentary, but if it was promoted as here's going to be this epic takedown of the film, that's not at all what this was. It doesn't really go beyond the couple of lines that you mentioned where they mentioned that the family found out about the project like everyone else did. And Kevin saying, yes, he endorsed the film, but he wanted to correct a few matters on the record. And yeah, that was about it. I mean, they really didn't, as you say, bury the film.
Yeah. And So they just like go through it sort of chronologically. And like a lot of people forget the fact that, Fritz and Doris, their oldest child, Jackie Jr., was the first child that died. He was born in 1952. And when he was six, and this is when Fritz was stationed up in Buffalo wrestling, that he died going to play at a friend's house. And so the story you get here is the fact, and the way I've always heard it, it was that he got electrocuted and like collapsed in a puddle and died. And you got a bit more with Kevin's recollection here and explaining that he was going to play at a friend's house. Mm-hmm. And then when it was time for dinner, Doris called the friend's house, who stated, Jackie's not here. He never came over. And she just loses it. And then they find him. Like, it's just like any parent's like absolute nightmare, just a horror story here. And it is kind of this insight into Fritz, which you have to look at the initial, as much as Fritz is a conflicted, certainly a flawed figure in many ways, like look at this. And I think this is probably this tragedy that he never copes with. And I don't think he copes with any of his son's deaths. And it's explaining here, his reaction is to just have more children with Doris to quote unquote fix this problem rather than grieve. And this is a very like of this era, like of people that, I mean, like men do not cry, men do not grieve. And he drilled that into his children too, about when their brothers would die. Like, we do not show weakness in public. Like, you don't cry, you don't show that weakness. And you just, you build up all this unresolved tragedy that is just grows and grows in this family's history, which is, it's stunning.
Yeah. Pinsky talks about it being sort of, there's a deal of speculative stuff in what he says, but this does ring true that at that time, you know, the loss of a child at 6 years old, it was a sort of a common way of coping is to try and basically replace the child by having more, you know, and that's what seems to be what happened.
Yeah, because Kevin was very young at the time, and I believe that Carrie was either had just been born or was born just after Jackie Jr.'s death. I don't have like my timeline right in front of me here, but that's just like Kevin was old enough that could even remember Jackie Jr. And so Kevin, you know, everyone thinks of him as the oldest, and for most of their lives he was, but he in fact did have an older brother for a time. They do a pretty good job of just kind of establishing who Fritz was, running the territory when he Ed McLemore was the big promoter that he would end up, having this battle with. And Texas was broken up into many different promoters, but Fritz basically had Dallas, Fort Worth, and then he would run other towns as well. But really it's the early 70s. They have a huge period in Dallas where Fritz is the big star of the territory. And then it's, you fast forward to the 80s, and it's Fritz retiring in 1982. And the big focus is on the children, who this is still a relatively like smaller territory where a lot of the people in the city, like they grew up seeing these Von Erichs grow up, and you had that attachment to these kids who are now becoming like these big athletes at the schools. They're being shown on television, and now they're growing up and they're becoming the stars of the territory. And it's also this cutting edge television show with all the production values that they introduced. And they went into that, like, multiple camera shoots and miking the ring and stuff that was so novel at the time, that was way ahead of its time. And it made world class such a state of the art television show for pro wrestling. That was kind of just a couple cameras, and you just have the static shot on. It was just total different way of producing wrestling television.
And they mentioned that this got it to be distributed across the entirety of the US instead of just in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and even internationally.
Yeah, like they, at the big deal. Yeah, they had like a 2-hour show Saturday nights that would air, and then they would have the 1-hour Sunday show that got syndicated in all over the place, and even overseas. So it was a massive reach that they were able to get. Even the Saturday night show was going into like Oklahoma. So it was like a big coverage area that they had for their television, and doing like tremendous audiences as well for it. And so, like we've talked about it before, like the big angle on Christmas night of 1982 is with the Freebirds and Terry Gordy smashing the cage door on Carrie's head, and Flair retains the title, and that just lights up the territory with the Von Erichs and the Freebirds. And so 83 is a massive year coming off of that, and it's in early 1984 when David is heading over to All Japan for a tour, and before he has his first match on the tour, he's found dead in his hotel room. And this is kind of the first massive tragedy that is focused upon, at least among the brothers as wrestlers at this point. And this was, you know, obviously 1984. I'm not around for this time period, but you know, it is one that is covered as such a massive deal in Texas. There's a huge outpouring of people, like thousands showing up for the funeral. And they kind of look at, over time, the death certificate had always listed acute enteritis as the cause of death for David. And he had definitely like been sick going into this tour and complaining of pain, and even, you know, showing his hesitation to go on the tour, and Fritz kind of pushing him like, you've got this commitment and you've sold tickets, like you've got to go on this tour. And he does. So it's like that. It's the source of contention comes with the fact that allegedly like Bruiser Brody was one to come find him and flush the pills that were found there down the toilet. And the theory of, well, was this a drug overdose? Was this from the enteritis? What was it a fact of that there could have been, that there were pills there, but it was this, like, he clearly had this abdominal issue that had been plaguing him for weeks, and he had been throwing up blood. He had been complaining about pain. It's visible when you see him in some of his last matches, that it's one that, they try to kind of break this down. And this is where, Drew Pinsky kind of gives his own assessment of this, that at that time, I'll get the exact wording here, but how did you feel about just what you learned and what you felt were the main points of this, this death with David?
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
I thought it was interesting that Bruiser Brody's not mentioned at all in this documentary, neither. And Flair, I think, is one of the people who put that out there, you know, that this theory about pills being removed from the hotel room. I felt it was handled all right. You know, there does seem to be some mystery about it. He wasn't feeling well, beforehand. And they have witnesses who said, you know, he told us that. But I'm one for going for the official cause of death. And it looks like that this gastroenteritis, whatever the cause, maybe drugs had some bearing on that. But, I think Drew Pinsky talks about a rupture because of too much matter and all this kind of detail that he couldn't possibly know.
Yeah. So, as they go through this, and first of all, there's a point in this where they are interviewing Kevin about this, and just like, remember the fact this is over 40 years since this has happened, and Kevin just needs to literally stop talking during this interview and take a break. And every time, like, when I think about all the different pieces and books and documentaries and stuff that I've read about involving Kevin, it's just the amount of times he has to relive these things and has to go through them. I can't imagine, like, the amount of times he has had to sit down and talk about these just horrific events in his life. And it's just like a reminder here that all these years later, this is probably no easier for him to reconcile than it was in 1984. And I thought it was like, Kevin is, I think, tremendous in this whole piece. But so it's David Manning who gets the call from Japan alerting him that David has died. And Manning is the one who has to drive out and inform Fritz and Doris of David's death. And so Fritz apparently tells David Manning that to find out what happened to him. And it's the autopsy that comes back with this acute enteritis. And Dr. Drew takes issue with gastroenteritis contributing to his death and states there are many times that medical examiners misdiagnose substance-related death. He says there has to be something more than gastroenteritis, and then suspects that it was opiate-induced, which would have ruptured his colon and then become septic. He says this is a common thing. Again, this is very speculative. I mean, when you're stating that it's there's many times that medical examiners misdiagnose this, I was like, well, was this one of those times? Like, it was very clear he had an abdominal issue. I don't have a doubt that there were pills in his hotel room, but I think it is quite another matter if he, in fact, overdosed here. And the fact is, like, this is, you know, I think at this point as well, it would be one where, yes, there was a lot of image protection that the Von Erichs had, but I think at this point in time, I don't know. I find this to be one that it's like, there is not that proof to me that gives you that knowledge to be able to say authoritatively what is to contradict what we do know was the case of how sick he was. Yeah.
It didn't sit particularly well with me either, the kind of the level of speculation on this.
So it's kind of the fallout of all of that. They do the big David Von Erich Parade of Champions in May of 1984. That's where Kerry wins the title and Fritz comes out of retirement. And I don't want to just like go through this all like in this kind of linear fashion, but I do want to point out certain reactions to these big moments. I thought Lacey Von Erich was really, really good in several of these. She's not in this a whole lot, but I thought the strongest scene she had was they show her this match of her father winning the NWA championship from Ric Flair, which was always like the whole territory was built around a Von Erich winning this title. So it's like this big moment that Fritz couldn't do it. David was going to be champion, but now Kerry is fulfilling the family legacy. And Lacey watches this, and she's stating this is the first time she's ever watched this match.
Yeah.
And she watches it. And, you know, she's seeing her father celebrating with this title, and she just responds, "This is what granddad was going for, right? You're the champion. Everyone's rooting for your family. But in reality, do you feel like you're winning? Your son is dead. Are your kids happy? I don't understand the goal. And after winning this title, why did we keep going? And I think it's a really grounded response to like someone even though someone that was in the industry that feels like just so removed from like fantasy world, pro wrestling, and more so of, okay, it's like, it's this great symbolic moment that you're winning the title for your deceased brother, but it's like, the end of the day, it's like, this does not replace anything, and what are we doing here? And I think this is someone as well that, let's remember, she's 6 when Carrie dies. Yeah. Like, she is growing up as a member of the Atkinson family, and it has had to live with all of this family tragedy after family tragedy. You can understand why this is the response that she would have for this. But I just found it to be a really enlightening reaction to just watching a match of her father's and just really questioning, like, it's a belt and it's something that means something to this audience that's there. But again, it's kind of this underlying theme of, is this really grieving? Is this really addressing the loss? And instead just, we're moving on and it's the next town and it's the next match. And that's just what we do. We just keep going.
Yeah. Someone has to tie again. It feels like every time one of these tragedies occurs, and her response is very grounded. Like you said, John, I think that one of the real strengths of the documentary is the access to the family, Kevin, of course, but also both of Carrie's daughters who appeared, and Holly being the other one who I find very affecting as well on this.
And a lot of old family footage that they had.
Yeah, footage was tremendous.
There's been a number of these kinds of pieces on the Von Erichs. Mainly the two big ones that came out very close to one another in 2006 was the WWE, Triumph and Tragedy of World Class DVD. And then this producer, Brian Harrison, put out an independent one that did have Kevin's involvement in it. And they were both very good. We'll talk about this later, but I mean, this was like newfound footage that like was not utilized in some of those pieces either. The next one is Mike. And so when David dies, they do kind of what was the precursor to like the tribute shows you'd see WWE do years later. And it's sort of, as much as you're seeing these guys out of character reacting to David's death, and it ends with this interview where Bill Mercer is out at the family ranch with Fritz, with Carrie, with Kevin, and with Mike, who had just started wrestling like a month or two earlier. And there's Fritz, and he's reacting to the death of his son David, and he just is looking at Mike and stating, you know, Mike, you're the spitting image of David. And it's like you can almost see the wheels turning. Like, here is the next Von Erich, and you're going to be David's successor. And that's kind of like, Mike was not a guy that was like all that into wrestling. Like, he was interested in music. He was interested in working in the production end for the company, but he's a Von Erich, and he's in way over his head and ends up dislocating his shoulder on a tour of Israel and ends up contracting toxic shock syndrome due to complications of the surgery, and nearly dies when he has a fever of 107 degrees, but miraculously lives. And he is never the same after this. He sustains brain damage for the amount of time with this fever. And like you see, you know, the press is here at the hospital, so they're wheeling him out to talk to the press, and he just looks like a skeleton. Yeah. And
he has this, it's really powerful.
It's troubling. Like, he just does not look like this guy is not here. And
he just has this 1,000-yard stare and this sort of this half smile on his face. You could tell that the guy is not right.
And he's, you know, he's brought back to, like, it's like 6 months later, he's wrestling, he's promoted as like the living miracle. It is, and it's just, he's running it, like, you couple it with the fact that he is probably like severely damaged from this whole incident. He's getting into, there's drug issues, there's arrests that occur for him. Like, he's just spiraling at this point. And then he goes missing in April of 1987, and they find a note, and he states, I'm sorry, I'm a fuck up. And they find him in a sleeping bag out in the woods, and he's overdosed on pills, believe it was like Placidil and but here is the next tragedy in April of 1987. And now it's starting to become like this, like it's right after that, suddenly the David Von Erich Parade of it's now the David and Mike Von Erich Memorial. And you're this audience that grew up with them. It's like David is the, just this unexpected tragedy and people are consumed with their emotions. And now with Mike, it's, and more to come. Now it's starting to become this bizarre, like what is going on is kind of the question that is starting to.
I'm just to underline this, you know, David died in Japan at 25 and Mike with this overdose, he was 23. I mean, these are very young men.
Yeah. I mean, that's the part that the older you get and you look back at some of these, like these are like what Chris Jericho says, like these were kids. Like we're talking about, like, think of like 25 for David and 23, and we're going to get younger here. You know, this is when, and by the time Mike dies, like we're past the glory days, like World Class is really struggling at this point. And this is when, you know, shortly afterwards, they go into, Carrie next. And with Carrie, they do kind of go backwards because you have to tell the story of the motorcycle accident, which is depicted in the movie, but it's done. I think the timing of it, they make it out that he wins the title from Ric Flair. And then later that night he has the motorcycle accident, but really they're 2 years apart where he goes into a parked police car. Apparently he was barefoot and just mangles his leg. And it's not initially that they have to amputate a portion of it. It's they rush him back and they try to do one match and he destroys it. So he like undoes the damage and then they have to amputate the portion of it that they describe here. And he still comes back and it's just kept ultra secret that he has had this amputation. And again, you had people in the office who were saying this might be an inspirational story of Carrie and Fritz. It's just no, like there will not be any. Again, it's like this would be perceived as some kind of weakness or diminishment of my son. And it was kept very, very under wraps until eventually it made its way into kind of the wrestling, you know, rumor mill.
Yeah. And this was, I mean, something I wasn't very clear on. My understanding was that he'd had the motorcycle accident led directly to the amputation of part of his foot, but that is not what happened. His foot was very badly damaged, but it was still intact after the accident, and it was damaged in the ring, perhaps been rushing him back.
Like the amputation was probably right, like roughly just before Mike died, like early 87, around that time, that time frame. So like that's kind of what Carrie is dealing with from, you know, 86, 87 onward. Now before we get to like the worst of Carrie, you also have Chris, who was, you know, by all accounts, just like, first of all, he idolized Carrie and just we talk about how Mike just did not have a desire for this. Chris was the opposite. This guy wanted to be his big brothers. He wanted to be a big wrestling star, but he did not have the size. He had asthma. They suggest that if he was on prednisone, this might have like stunted his growth. He was like 5'5" and also was like prone to injuries. And you can watch some of the like the later World Class stuff, and he's working with like Percy Pringle, and it's just, I mean, like I'm someone like the size thing is not like a big deterrent today for people, but you just watch it and it's just really tough to imagine, like in this era, we're talking late 80s and it's or early 90s, and just like there was just no hope of this being successful. And then, yeah, he breaks his shoulder in a match, just doing a routine drop kick. And, you know, his ending, this is a really sad story because Kevin explains the story that when Mike died, he had left his scuba gear for Chris because they would go scuba diving together. And Chris had this scuba gear, and when he opened it, there was like Placidil in it. He had left him pills. as this, like, you'll know what to do with these. And in September of 91, it's not pills, but Chris ends up, first off, calling Kevin's daughter to state, I love you, and tell the whole family I love them. And he took his motorcycle into the woods. Kevin states that he found Chris and sent Kevin to go read his note. And then when he got to the main house, he read it and then raced back, but it was too late because Chris had shot himself. And he just describes in horrific detail, like, holding Chris after the gunshot. Like, it's the most chilling stuff. And you can hear this story so many times. It's not less shocking any other additional time that you hear about this.
No, particularly when you hear it from Kevin's mouth. You know, he talks about Chris shot himself in the head, and Kevin is trying to, on the top of this hill on their property, trying to lift his head up, and he talks about his fingers being able to feel the wound and the hot blood. And so you just wonder how this guy, Kevin Von Erich, was able to stand all of this. You know, his brother's just disappearing one by one. And this, like, is so tragic because see these photographs and some footage of Chris, and you just feel, why did they allow him to, even as keen as he was to become a wrestler, you know, he just was clearly not fit to do it.
In some way, he is, like, these are all tragedies, but I look at the one with Chris and it's just like, he so badly wanted this, and it was just like, it was so beyond, like, it was so out of the reality of what was going to come. And, you know, you also look at back, when it was, the Dark Side of the Ring episode on the Graham family, and you had, Mike Graham's daughter, like, talking about, like, the generations of suicide in their family, and just the statistics of how much more prevalent suicide becomes when there is somebody in the family that has ended their life in that fashion. And, like, you're looking at this, and, like, that's what these brothers are essentially, like, you know, it's, you can't even put it into words. Like, it's just, you go through this, and it's just this horrific cycle that these brothers were in. And it is a miracle that Kevin lasted through all of this, that is able to be now living, like, a relatively comfortable life, and that seems to be in, you know, relatively fine spirits. He has a family. Mm-hmm. You know, it's remarkable when you go through something like this. So Chris dies. It's September of 1991. And by this point, Carey has gone to the WWF, and he has his run there, but he's, you know, he's also he's very dependent on drugs. He gets released by the WWF in 1992, and they actually send him to rehab, which he goes through, but I mean, it's not something that keeps him on the straight and narrow. And then it's after it's an issue of, like, forgery for prescription drugs that he gets arrested in early 93. And it was looking like he was likely to face jail time. And this is the portion of the documentary where we hear the most from Holly, who would be his oldest daughter, and I believe was 9 at the time in 1993. We've talked about a lot of, like, really, just heartbreaking stuff. To me, nothing was tougher to hear than Holly recounting and just trying her best to recount this. Of first, it's the story of her and her sister playing out in the yard with Chris Adams while they assume their father was inside getting drugs from Chris Adams, and the police show up, and it's this big arrest, and Holly and Lacey are taken to a juvenile cell, and Carey's arrested on cocaine possession that day, and he gets released, and Carey has taken Holly out for dinner, and this is where Carey tells his 9-year-old daughter his plans to kill himself. And Holly's response is, "No, Daddy, when you die, I die." And Carey says that, "If you tell anyone this, I'll know about it and I'll die." So Holly told no one. Dude, I've never heard that story before. I don't know if Holly shared it before, but I had never heard it before. And I was stunned listening to this. And I know that if you are at that level where you are contemplating suicide, you're obviously not in the right frame of mind. But man, to just to put that on this 9-year-old child, I just found this to be like the most heartbreaking story in a whole 2-hour episode of similar stories.
Yeah, same here. It had the same effect on me. I was absolutely shocked to hear this. I don't know if the story was ever out there, but to hear it from so emotionally from Holly herself in her own words telling the story was just incredible.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
And like, you hear from Holly and from Lacey, and like, they then and now, like, Carrie is their hero. Like, they for all of like his faults, these arrests, like, this was not a perfect individual, but they love this guy. And you got that sentiment from a lot of people in the industry that Carrie was just like this very laid back guy that was just, you know, he had a ton of problems, obviously, but I mean, seemed like a guy with like a really good heart. And these daughters, like, even today, like, they idolize this guy.
Yeah.
It was very sad. And at this point, it's just like, you're just looking at what this 9-year period has generated with David, with Mike, with Chris, and now Carrie, all gone. And it's kind of just David Manning explains how Fritz was just broken after Carrie's death. Kevin would wrestle again through like 95. And then the ending of this, they spend like the last little portion sort of just correcting the record on certain elements from the movie about it. They note that they weren't consulted, but they read about it online. And Lacey said it was heart-wrenching of how inaccurate their father was portrayed, and as well as Chris being left out and portraying Fritz as this villain. And listen, there's a certain aspect that you always have to look at. And I speak about this sometimes when we talk about various books, when you have the subject that is involved. And I'll sometimes ask authors, like, it's obviously on the front. You say, if I'm writing a biography on X, do you want that person involved? The natural reaction is, well, of course, I want to have them involved. At the same time, when you, it's like, to, you're making this movie, and it's like, to the family, like, that is, they have their view, and you kind of have to be able to take like a nuanced look at a person like Fritz, who I'm sure to his direct family, there's a lot that we, the public, will never see of Fritz that made him this person that they would never see as a villain. But I think we also have to look at the result, the many stories of Fritz, how he, you know, was a very demanding father. I think you have to be able to present characters that sometimes are going to be counter to how his closest family members are going to see him, which is going to be a different light. And you have to present them in that way.
I think that's a natural thing, that within an insular family unit, people are going to see granddad, you know, in a different light. The fact of the matter is, it's not disputed that he did rush the kids back into the ring every time there was one of these tragedies. And there was only one occasion, I think, where Kevin pushed back. And I think that was after Mike died, I don't think it was David. I think it was after Mike.
I think it was Mike.
We are not doing it. Kevin or Carrie and I are not wrestling at this time. You know, Fritz wanted them to. So, I mean, you just have to look at those factual matters, as you said, sort of in a slightly detached manner from what the family unit would think.
Yeah, and Kevin is asked here at the end if he ever blamed Fritz for what happened. And he told this story earlier, that when he learned, Carrie had been, you know, not just to Holly, he had been allegedly had told Kevin as well, like right before. And I think this is depicted in the movie, as I recall, but that Kevin calls Fritz to warn him about if Carrie comes by, or to watch him, and somehow if, like, Fritz didn't take his call or just hung up on him, something like that. Yeah. And Kevin said he was upset with him about that. But he overrides everything, knowing that Fritz lost his sons. And you know, Kevin has always been like, he has always shared some of like the worst stories of Fritz, but has always underlined it with like a love that he had for his father. But it's not as though he just is in denial about, you know, some of the things with Fritz that were really challenging for a son to try and understand, even one that, like an older like Kevin Von Erich today. I just thought Kevin Von Erich was tremendous in this. Like, really, I thought both of Carrie's children, I thought, added a lot to this as well. And yeah, it was
even in small portions, John, you know, Pam, Kevin's wife, and Kristen, his daughter, you know, just fill in little blanks here and there. I think that's one of the big strengths of this documentary, is the level of access to the surviving Atkinsons.
Yeah. I'll just say this, like, again, I don't want to, like, you know, say I'm like some authority or anything, but like, just I found like I learned a lot in this. I put this like at the level of any of your other pieces on the Von Erichs. And in the show description, I'm going to link to that audio documentary I did, as well as some other there's this great D Magazine article from 1988 on the Von Erich family that's free to read as well. So some other stuff as well, if you're interested. It's a tragic but a really fascinating story. It's a very sad one, but I feel that this was like, I was really impressed with this 2-hour episode that uncovered a lot of different aspects that I've just not heard either outright stated or presented with kind of like a different way of looking at some of these other stories that we were aware of. And it's the family that are the reason for this being as strong as it is.
The family and the footage and the still photographs, family photographs, and you know, it's silent cine camera footage of the kids when they're together and they're young. It all just adds up to a tremendous package. I think actually the linchpin of this series seems to be Dr. Drew Pinsky, and he's my only gripe with this, where he's put on the spot to kind of, well, what do you really think, you know, happened here? Was it septic shock or toxic shock? And none of that really matters. As wrestling fans, at least, who want to know the history of this, you could have taken most of his parts out of it. But yeah, in general, I think this is really good and well worth seeking out. And I can tell the listeners that you can find this if you're international and maybe you don't have access to Discovery Plus. It is out there in the usual sort of places. You might search YouTube adjacent type sites. It's easily found.
Well, Neil, I want to thank you very much for spending the time to watch that and chat about it with me. Because when I watched this, I was like, I really would like to talk about this. And I was glad that you were able to fit this in.
I was very glad that you asked, John, because it was a really good documentary. I got a lot out of it.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
If your job at a healthcare facility includes disinfecting against viruses, you know prevention is the best medicine. And maintaining healthy spaces starts with a healthy cleaning routine. Grainger's world-class supply chain helps ensure you have the quality products you need when you need them. From disinfectants and cleaning supplies to personal protective equipment, so you can help deliver a clean bill of health. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.